Welcome back to Midnight in the Mountains, and it's Laura here. On this episode, I have a longtime friend of the show, Chaz, with me. He is a paranormal writer, researcher, and traveling investigator. So we talk about his investigation in the Betts Mansion, where the famous Betts Sphere was found. We had a lot of fun talking about it, and we kind of went off the rails a little bit, but I think we brought it back on the track. So hopefully you guys will get a few laughs out of this episode. And in the show notes down below, I put the link to the petition that Chaz started to save the Betts Mansion, and also there are other links to find Chaz. So now, that being said, I just want to say, if you guys are listening to this, I am trying to actively work on my audio quality and get some better equipment to make things sound better. So if you've been listening this far, I just want to say thank you very much. And last but not least, if you have a true paranormal story you would like to share with me or have it read on the show, or even be a guest on the show if you have a lifetime of experiences that you would like to share, send me an email at midnight_inthemountains@yahoo.com. All right, guys, let's get into it. Oh, and we're not using the video.
Oh, okay.
So you're fixing your hair and you're like,
"Oh, I am." I'm like, "Awesome. Okay. There we go."
I'm like, "Dude, you're fine. Like, we're not. Cool. This good. Isn't going anywhere. I get good. Like, the video doesn't go anywhere." So,
relax.
I feel like I should leave that in the recording.
That's funny.
All right. So, I'm back with you. Oh, I'm so awkward at this. I hate this.
So, no worries. Long time friend of the show.
Long time friend of the show.
The pleasantries.
Yeah, right. So I follow you on Instagram and you're constantly going to all these really cool places. I definitely want to hear about them. Like, are you doing historic tours when you go there? Are you investigating with paranormal equipment, or what are you doing there?
Yeah. So that Instagram is at Chaz of the Dead. I'm Chaz, by the way, for first time listeners, paranormal investigator, researcher, writer, adventurer, all that stuff. I film locations, haunted locations that I go to, and try to give a quick rundown on, you know, the history of those locations and why they're supposedly haunted and, you know, the supposed phenomenon associated with them. And sometimes I stick around and investigate. I always like to bring some, you know, paranormal equipment. I'm not really big on EVPs and like orbs and stuff, though. There's a lot of, I don't want to say junk science, but I can't think of a better term right now, so I'm going with it. There's a lot of junk science in ghost hunting and stuff, so I try to avoid some of that, but I do take my EMF readings. I've got, you know, some temperature measuring equipment. I do try to, you know, pick out locations that I think are interesting. But when I like to stay at a location, that's when it's got to be a little more than just interesting. You know, I go to a lot of houses and hotels and stuff, and they're like, "It's haunted." And you're like, okay, you know, it's an old building. It's got some interesting stories and interesting history, which, of course, is always fun to learn about and share. But every once in a while, I'm across a location like, ooh, there's something weird about this place. Like, a little off. The stories seem a little more true, you know. And it's hard. And I guess that feeling's different for everyone. You know, I know people who go to locations where I've been like, meh, and they've been like, oh, and, you know, vice versa. So it's definitely a personal experience, which I think a large portion of the paranormal is. But I definitely like going to these locations. I've always been big on the travel aspect of doing research and looking into locations. I like sharing that with the followers over on all the social medias.
I definitely agree that each place is different for each person, and it just depends. Like, you could have something going on in your life and that spirit could connect with you, or, you know, and some people are more sensitive than others. How do you feel about REM pods and stuff like that? I mean, I know you just said you're not big on the EVPs.
Yeah, the REM pod's an interesting piece of technology. So I don't own one. I've used one a couple times.
So what was your experience using it?
So I feel like a lot of these sensors and stuff, there's a certain, it seems like a more expensive version of that like flashlight experiment you see in a lot of like paranormal documentaries where they untwist the battery to the point where it's barely touching, and then they kind of ask it questions, flickers. A lot of the more sciencey, supposedly sciencey ghost tech plays on that same principle. You know, even the EMF detector, you know, there's so much EMF stuff just in our air already from cell phones and satellites, and, you know, any electronic device gives off an EMF, and other stuff that you might not even think about. Insect nests can give off small.
Really?
There's whole kinds of other shit that, you know, could be causing that spike. And that applies, of course, for the REM pods as well. That's why, you know, we've got hundreds of hours of footage of those things going off, but no scientist has been like, well, let me look at this. It's because when you do look, there's a myriad of things that could be causing that. Now, the basis of all of those experiments, though, and you know, there's probably some ghost hunters screaming at their, you know, earphones right now. this very point is that it occurs in a very synchronistic fashion, right? They'd say they like to call it an intelligent response, right?
That was going to be my point to bring up next. Yeah,
right. Like flash twice, and you know, if it's a yes, or once if it's a no, and then you know they answer the question in a seemingly intelligent manner.
I mean, some that stuff, but you got to admit, though, sometimes that stuff just hits so hard right on cue all the time. Like, that can't be completely, like, synchronized.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I definitely agree. There's something paranormal going on in those situations. I personally am a fan of the super ESP theory.
What is that?
The tulpa theory. Some people might use that terminology.
Maybe like a tulpa?
Yeah. Egregore, whatever. There's a million words for it. I tend to think it's those responses are a reflection of our like subconscious ESP. Like in those cases we're manifesting that to happen.
And I've heard that. Isn't that wild? Like that just trips me up to think about that.
Oh, absolutely. I didn't mean
to cut you off, but that stuff's crazy to me.
Well, it's one of the best theories out there because there's a decent amount of actual scientific research into the idea. The Philip experiments, one that gets cited.
I was just going to say that, yeah.
And that one's not the most scientific, but it is certainly intriguing. And the fact that it has been repeated. And, they did an experiment, I think, in Australia. I forget what they named that one, but it got the same results where they, for those unfamiliar, they made up a ghost. They named him Philip, and they gave him, you know, a tragic backstory. They gave him almost like a classic haunting kind of story. And he was a completely made up figure, but they started to get phenomenon that would, you know, just like in these ghost hunts, they would knock, you know, responses saying yes to questions about its history. And again, a completely made up history. But it was manifesting this paranormal activity. And it's something that I think was kind of more understood 100 years ago, 150 years ago, in the kind of the boom of the seance movement. Now, of course, the traditional seances and stuff, there was a lot of people pulling a lot of, you know, frauds and scams on people. There's a good volume of research done by legitimate professors and scientists. And again, it was the 1800s, early 1900s. They could have been getting duped. They're not, you know, we learn as we age through history. But they were legitimately confused by some of the phenomenon presented in some of these seances. You know, one of the best examples, and this is re-reported by Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove, who does some great research into these concepts. But they had like a pool, like a fish tank full of gel, like this weird gel. And they got handprints. They asked the spirit to put its hands in the gel, and these physical handprints manifested. And, you know, it was this specific type of material so they could look at the fingerprints. And the fingerprints didn't match anyone, you know, inside the seance room. And again, they watched these handprints manifest. So there's some really intriguing things that seems to happen when a group of people get together and start to get spooked. And you're spooked combines with everyone else's spooked. And it seems to create it meets this expectation almost, right? Mm-hmm. You get a group of people together and then you change their reality a little bit, and reality starts to meet those expectations of that group of people. Especially when you're confined in a dark and spooky room, or if you're in like an abandoned mental hospital all by yourself, all those factors just serve to amplify that effect. Or it could be ghosts. You know, I don't want to poo-poo. I'm not saying I know this like a fact.
Oh, yeah. No, I totally get you, because there's a few things there with what you just said. If you go back to the Fox sisters, they even, had admitted to hoaxing. But then it kind of circled back where it actually wasn't a hoax and they were actually getting these responses. So it's like, do you know what I'm talking about, right?
Right.
So
this actually seems to pop up a lot in legitimate paranormal cases, especially poltergeist cases. There seems to be a burst of activity at the start that's legitimate and paranormal. And then, you know, more and more people get involved. And this, again, I think tends to lead evidence towards the tulpa theory. More and more people get involved, more and more realities clash with this entity. And then typically the kids that are the center of these poltergeist activity will start faking some of the activity because it doesn't perform on command. And they're like, oh, well, you know, people are expecting this of me and so on and so forth. You know, it's very similar to how, you know, you can get a kid to confess to the police can very easily trick a child into a false confession. This kind of false expectation arises and the kid's like, oh, well, I'm going to throw a rock like the ghost did and meet that expectation. And that happens a lot in the Black Monk of Pontefract case over in the UK. That was something that occurred. A lot of these cases occur that it seems to be real legitimate activity at the start, and then it kind of trails off into more, you know, like scamish type of behavior. But from the get, it seems that this activity only occurs if there's a possibility it could be fake. And there's a really interesting, intriguing poltergeist case from Russia that kind of displays this. And this group testifies that this footage is legitimate, but it doesn't look it. And let me explain why. So the poltergeist, its main activity zone was in this hallway, and it would throw things down the hallway. It had this habit of tearing the bathroom door off its hinges. Now, the hinges wouldn't be broken. It would be almost teleported off of the hinges and then thrown down the hallway. And they tried to put cameras down the hallway and look at it, and activity would just occur in other parts of the house. And they could only catch the hallway activity by putting a camera in another room and looking through a doorway at like a certain amount of distance. And then the activity would continue, but there's that doorway there. So you can never be sure if someone, like watching it, you're like, well, someone's probably just standing right there throwing shit. You know, you can't definitively say that's, you know, oh, that's paranormal. And in one instance, the bathroom door flies down the hall and it lands in a way that creates even a more obscured view. And it almost looks like there's something crawling around that, like a person crawling around back there, grabbing things and throwing them up. And you're like, well, this looks absolutely ridiculous. This is the worst footage. It's someone clearly faking it. And then in the very next video, which is super intriguing, there's a bird cage. And it's a bird inside a bird cage. It gets thrown down this hallway and stops. And this really kind of unnatural, like it's traveling really fast and then stops right in the middle of the camera frame. And they rush around the corner and look, and no one's there. And the birdcage had been inside this closed bedroom before. And they approach the bedroom, they open it up, and there's a sleeping dog in front of the door. And they kind of hit the dog, and the dog wakes up and gets out of the way. And they flick on the lights, and the kids sleeping in the room are like, what happened? And they're like, it's outside now. And very interesting. And, you know, all of this maybe could be faked, you know, camera tricks. The most intriguing part was the bird inside the cage was in like this catatonic state. It like wasn't squawking. It wasn't moving. It was almost sleeping, kind of standing up. And, you know, it was alive. They like touched it and it kind of like flirted back to life. But, you know, for them to train a bird as part of this ruse is a little much. Now it's kind of curious. And that intelligence of the phenomenon is something that pops up again and again, where it knows that it's being recorded, you know, and
yeah.
Skinwalker mm-hmm. Ranch is a good example of this, where they
Bigfoot's
had...
Bigfoot's a good example of that, too.
Oh, yeah, very much so. He seems to be a tease. He'll pop up on camera only for a little bit here and there, and then he's gone. But in Skinwalker Ranch, where Robert Bigelow had all those trained scientists, he was paying them to document what was going on. And even with the current cheesy TV show they got out, the scientists reported was that they'd set up these cameras... And then the activity would happen just off camera. They'd
right.
see with their eyes, and they could like maybe see a glow in the camera of a light off in the distance, but they could never capture. And then they adjust the cameras, and it would happen in a different place. And it seems that this phenomenon, the camera affects it. You know, it's camera shot. No one behaves the same way when they're being filmed.
And no, definitely not. Look at how we started the podcast. Exactly. I was fine. And it was like,
we'll definitely leave it in now.
Yeah. Like stuttering and, oh, I don't know what to say.
I could juggle my hair around. yeah. And so the phenomenon seems to have that same kind of awkwardness about it. It doesn't like to be filmed. And if it is being filmed, there's an out. There's a, oh, it could be something else. It could be something, you know. And again, this seems to be a little bit of a crucial part of why or how the phenomenon pops up. You know, if we 100% know it's a ghost, well, that it just never seems to really happen. There's people out there who claim they believe 100%. But there's always that possibility of fraud, and especially in some of the most intriguing cases. And even when it comes to individual, you've got your Madame Blavatsky's, who at the start of her career seemed to be really, you know, pulling some crazy magical predictions and manifesting notes and all kinds of stuff. And again, you could play a lot of that up to magicians' tricks and whatnot. But a lot of people looked into it and investigated it. And early in her career, they were convinced. It was the Thule Society went on to be the religion of many of the top Nazis. It was a huge movement in Europe. But late in her career, people caught her doing like, with like fishing wire, doing, you know, but, classic little tricks and stuff.
Yeah. So I'm not familiar with her. Who, like, what did she do?
So she claimed she was in contact with these hidden masters from Tibet. And it was kind of this early occult movement that she kind of like kicked off in Europe. And Aleister Crowley and a lot of the famous European magicians kind of followed suit. And there's a lot of documentation to her displaying, you know, legitimate powers. And then there's some people at the end who said, oh, well, you know, she was doing these frauds. And again, once one fraud is exposed, they throw the baby out with the bathwater as far as skeptical thinking is. They're like, well, she faked a thing. That means she faked all of it. Well, how did she fake the... you know, stuff she, how'd she know about the stuff she wasn't there for? Like how could she channel that, you know, real information? Who knows? Well, she faked it. That's all you need to know. And so that problem pops up again and again and again in the paranormal. From haunted houses, Amityville is a good example of that. In New York, the Amityville Horror House, you know, 900 movies, famous murder, the DeFeo murders there. There's a kind of mixed reputation about what was true, what was faked. And the family did start having some weird phenomenon. And then one of their friends or their lawyer or whoever it was like, you know, you guys should like spin it off into a book. And so they beefed up some of the details. And ironically, the famous paranormal vultures, the Warrens, they showed up and they like did a little tour of the house for like 10 minutes and talked to the family. And then later on wrote a book about how, and they had this hours long demonic battle and they were, you know, really challenged by this demon. And then the original writers of the, you know, scary story was like, I mean, yeah, we made up a few things, but that's they're full of shit. Again, it serves as a perfect example of the gradient of information you're dealing with when you're talking paranormal shit, where you've got your full-blown role players like Ed and Lorraine Warren. The Annabelle doll, they bought it in the store. They've never been able to find anyone that can corroborate that story. Ed and Lorraine Warren bought that doll in the store and sold it as haunted. They were hucksters all the way through and through. But then you have people in the middle where, and it seems that these people in the middle experience the most phenomenon where they're not an entirely reliable witness. They're somewhere between, you know, Lorraine Warren and, you know, Bill Nye the Science Guy, where you've got your strict scientific mind. You've got, you know, us normal people somewhere in the middle. And it seems to be the phenomenon, again, hangs around these areas and these people. And again, in both of the poltergeist cases we were talking about, lower economic, both of those, the Russian one and the UK case, the Monk of Pontefract, government housing. There's this lower economic, you know, difficult situation that these families are in. And again, they start to get this intention and possibly some publicity and see it as an out. And then they start manifesting phenomenon. So
is that manifesting phenomenon that just happened in your house?
Is manifesting around me right now. The glass is shattering and breaking.
Everybody heard that, right?
Yeah, see, once you get together in a group, you're having a good time. That's when it manifests. Classic seance.
Oh my God. But so, okay, so this brings up a good point that I've been wondering for quite some time now. Say, and like I like to use Gettysburg as an example because people come from all over the country to go there. Now, these people come with all these emotions. They come with the idea that the place is already haunted. So how much of that haunting that people experience there, the energy or anything, is how much of that is put in from people just visiting the place and how much of it is left over from the Civil War? Like, questions like those drive me crazy because you could even take like a haunted hotel or something. You go there and there's all these ghost hunters that frequent that are like an asylum, I think, like you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And everybody's there for the same reason and you're putting that energy in it. How much of that is a manifested energy that is coming from, you know, an outside source rather than what's there?
Well, it's definitely hard to say, right? There's no
exactly, definitive
way to measure, you know, these kind of concepts. But the one thing I do like to point out is the one sure commonality through all haunting is typically a story. And having a violent, gruesome story seems to be the highest quality story you're going to get if you want to create a haunted location. And we've seen this with people who, you know, you've had shadier investigators and stuff who bought houses and made some less than scrupulous claims, but people go there and experience real phenomena. And again, those examples lean towards that tulpa. But once you hear a story and you know this history, especially if it's a true story, then it's almost the opposite of what we were just discussing before, how you need that little bit of the possibility of doubt. Well, and on the other spectrum, you need the possibility of belief. You have to have a weird story or something in there that makes you think, oh shit, maybe it is haunted. Maybe there are ghosts, or maybe there is an alien up there, you know? And once you have those contradicting ideas, that's where this phenomenon likes to hang out. You know, if the true believers, if it occurred, if the Pope was really talking to God, shit would be different, right? We all know that that's theater for the most part.
I don't trust anything that comes out of the Vatican.
Right, exactly. Those guys are sketchy weirdos. They're creeps. Their whole thing. There's not a lot of. They're not interacting with the phenomena. Let's put it that way. I don't want to get too political.
I think last episode before this, I said I was pro gun, so I think I'm gonna.
So
my listeners know where I'm at. And
well, you might. I've always been of the opinion. There's a lot of opinions out there on. Should we welcome the aliens? I think we should welcome them, but what was it? Teddy Roosevelt, carry a big stick, something like that. You know, don't trust them. They're shady and they're acting shady. So, you know, there's that idea, especially when it comes to UFOs, that they came here because of our nukes. And if that's true, then we probably want to hold on to the nukes. Like, if they're like, oh, that's important. Then it's important, you know. We don't want to throw out our only playing card. But when it comes to people who experience the phenomenon, the true believers, quote unquote, don't really experience it. And I mean, they might. You have doomsday predictions from preachers all the time who say, this is the end of the world. I talked to God. He told me it was true. So we're good. I've sold all my stuff. You should sell all your stuff. You know, it happens every 5 years here in the U.S., globally, probably once a month. You know, it's something that's common, and those never pan out. And again, you have your typical skeptics who will look at a video of a UFO that, the Navy professional pilots are like, that's a UFO. And they'll be like, nah, it's a weather balloon. You must have saw it wrong, Navy pilot. I'm an IT professional, and I say it's a weather balloon.
Yeah.
So, again, somewhere between that sits most people, and it is your random average person who experiences this stuff. It's about keeping an open mind, not to sound too cliche.
Yeah. I don't know. Where do we want to go next with this? I had a question, and I forgot it.
No worries.
Oh, okay. So, all right. So that all being said, what is one place that you've been to where you're like, okay, this really, really is haunted, that there's something going on here?
Yeah, I actually had the pleasure to investigate a place like that a couple times over the last few months as part of my new book coming out. And that location was the Betts Castle / Neff House. There's a couple names out there for it. And it's this crazy structure just north of Jacksonville, Florida, on this island that has a long history of strangeness. It was a plantation. Before that, a French explorer landed there, and his settlement was massacred by the Spanish. There was a native settlement on the island when the French dude landed. Hundreds of years of strange, and again, strange stories, violent stories, weird stories. And so this house is built onto the highest point of this island. It's the highest point in the entire county, actually. This house, it's bizarre. It's this European Tudor style. It's got this big tower at the front. It looks like a castle. And it was the sighting, the location of one of the strangest sagas in Floridian ufology to ever occur. So in 1974, well, let me get into the haunted history of the house first. So it was built for Nettleton Neff as this vacation home, but none of his family got to use it. They all died in tragic ways. He killed himself after his wife died in a mysterious fire, and his son also took his own life. He was attending Harvard and disappeared for 2 weeks, and they found him hanging in an apple grove. Very violent ends to their family, and so they never moved into this house. It was designed and built specifically for him by a famous architect, Melvin Greeley, who called it his most unique home. And it's weird. It's got all kinds of weird levels and shifts. It goes up and down. It has a basement, which is something that doesn't happen in Florida homes. It's got super bizarre. It's just this very strange structure, architecture. And on the inside, it's quite strange. So it sat empty for all these years, and kind of, you know, this spooky looking house on the top of a hill. It started to gather legends, like we've been discussing. No one ever died in the house, but it was the spooky house on the hill. People began to hear the telephone ring, even though there was no phone connected. They would hear organ music, even though an organ has never been in the house. But it's the kind of house you look and you like hear Dracula's castle, like, da-na-na! Like, oh, fuck. It's got that kind of aura about it. And so the locals of the area would you know, tell stories about this. And so it was built in the Gilded Age, 1920s, right before the Great Depression. And right before the Great Depression, this island, Fort George Island, was kind of like a schmoozy, fancy golf club retreat for the Jacksonville's elite. The Ribault Club, which is still there. It's a very beautiful structure, also built by Melvin. People have their weddings out there. It's very, very nice location. And in the woods off to the left, further down the road, there's this big old spooky haunted house. And so the golf course during the Depression, you know, all that stuff kind of fell apart. The golf course turned into Florida swamp jungle very quickly. And, you know, as the house kind of got swallowed up, it became even more spooky and even more mysterious. And then in 1974, this very enterprising woman, Jerry Betts, she very impressive, especially in the 70s. She owned a trucking company and a real estate company. She ran for city council, and there was like, there's a super sexist article that was written about her and a bunch of other women who were running for government positions in the 70s. It was titled, How Will These Women Keep House If They're In The... It was really ridiculous.
Somebody find him so I can punch him in the teeth.
Oh, it's rough. But she was, you know, she was regardless this titan of industry. And she heard this
good
story
for her.
About a spooky house. Oh, fascinating lady. She heard this story about the spooky house and was like, oh, cool, I'll buy it. I'm in. I want to go live there.
I like her even more.
Uh-huh. She fixed it up, added a wing to the house, you know, had some chickens, cleaned up the property, and really kind of turned this castle-looking structure into a really majestic piece of property. And in 1974, her adult son was walking around the island. There's mixed, the whole story's filled with reports. She might have been with him, might have not been. But he finds this big metal sphere, and thinking it's a cannonball or something historical because of the island's long history, he takes it home.
Hold on a minute. This is the sphere story?
The pet sphere,
this
yes.
This is the house?
Yes.
No way. I thought this was just like a super mundane, like normal family home. No big deal.
Right.
I
no
didn't
one
know
brings that, up. Yeah. This is
you
one
said
of
the
first.
Name, and I was like, oh, that reminds me of the sphere story.
Uh-huh.
And
the best sphere is how the case is most commonly referred to. No one brings up the fact that the entire story takes place in a famously haunted house.
They're totally bearing the lead there.
Right. It's well, and especially well in the 70s and still now you have this, you run up against this where you have people in ufology, you have your like real, your old head ufologists, MUFON and the like, who are like, they're machines and they come from a different planet. That's what they are. And ghosts. So that's ridiculous. Don't be insane. You know, there's this kind of like snooty attitude that, you know, my thing's real and everyone else is Bigfoot. Fuck that. What a bunch of morons those guys are. And there's this weird psychological thing that makes them think that delegitimizing the other phenomenon makes theirs, you know, somehow more legitimate. And ufology is kind of a centerpiece for that. It's still a very divided. You have the whole rank of people from, I know the reptilians are real, I hang out with them on the weekends, to, again, the guys I were just describing, where they're nuts and bolts. They're machines, and that's the end of the conversation. But nowadays we have this kind of new era, this new age of paranormal investigation. And it's, you know, one of the few positives of the internet where we can go and access all this information and see this bigger picture that was being denied before. So boom, we have a haunted house. We have an island that has a bunch of weird paranormal history. Well, not even paranormal history, just history, violent history from natives being converted to slavery of the plantation era. And again, that history is the entire reason Terry Betts picks up that sphere. He thinks it's a cannonball. He thinks it's something historical. And he takes it back home to his haunted house. And it actually sits there for 2 weeks doing nothing. And one day he starts playing guitar in his room and the sphere starts to vibrate and ring out. You can hear this high-pitched ring. And soon afterwards, it starts to move around and it moves around with this intelligence. Again, something we've been discussing in a lot of paranormal cases, the seeming intelligence that pops up. It kind of like follows them around the house like a pet dog. Interestingly, the Betts did have a dog who hated the sphere. It would whine and like freak out if you held it near it. So the sphere started to move around and they started to talk about it and local news showed up and radio people and plenty of people watched it do weird shit, move on its own. One of the radio hosts said that he saw it roll to the edge of a flat table and then just dangle off the edge in this, you know, kind of impossible physics way. The Navy got involved and investigated. J. Allen Hynek got involved and investigated. And by the end of this month, you know, a month and a half after they discovered the thing, Jerry Betts was like over it. She was like, okay, this was fun at first. I like living in the haunted house. I liked having the UFO sphere, but I'm being fucked with. And people would show up to her house at all hours, you know, just show up on her property and want to see the sphere. Her phone was ringing constantly. And again, she's a businesswoman and all of her calls are getting, you know, pushed back for these UFO calls. And something sketchy occurred. And there's several stories from several different sources about what that sketchy thing was. One story is that the Navy fucked with the ball and maybe swapped it out and they have the original one. Another version of the story is J. Allen Hynek, the famous ufologist. He stole the ball and his son gave an interview recently to a TV show about playing with a metal sphere from Florida in his dad's basement, which kind of spurred off this rumor that he perhaps had stolen it or wound up with the ball. Another story is that the family gave it to someone for safekeeping and they gave it to Hynek. I personally believe that the Navy stole the original sphere and then she gave the fake sphere to J. Allen Hynek. But again, none of it's clear. We have no idea what happened to this sphere other than at the end of this month, Jerry Betts was like, I'm done talking about it. We're done. The sphere's gone. We're not talking about it anymore. It's over. And it's kind of this whirlwind of this ufology story. So the mainstream media they dismiss the whole thing as a fake sphere. They say it's a metal ball from a pulp gauge from a paper plant. And that's why it's this big, weird metal sphere. And they found a woman who had one that kind of looked similar. And then they found a guy who said, I was driving around Jacksonville with a bunch of them in my truck and I lost one. Which is a really bad explanation because Fort George Island is a ways away from Jacksonville. It's across the St. John's River. It's a foresty, swampy island. If you were driving out there, you'd know. It's not like, oh, I dropped it in Jacksonville. So it, you know, oh, that was it. Very shoddy explanation. And again, you have dozens of eyewitnesses testifying to this ball moving on its own. So again, before all of this occurred, haunted house. And Jerry Betts herself experienced the haunting. She said they would see lights around the property. She speculated that it was phosphorus in the soil. Again, very kind of skeptical. But there was a dinner party, though, where inside the locked kitchen, inside locked cabinets, these dishes had somehow disappeared out of the cabinet and reappeared smashed on the floor. And all of her guests heard it, and they all, and she kind of played along like, oh, it's a haunted house. And they all went in and saw that these dishes had been destroyed in this, you know, a paranormal way. Again, these classic kind of haunting situations. So, of course, that begs the question of, was something related to the island or related to the house dictating the sphere and moving the sphere around? Was the ball haunted? That's definitely one theory. But the story of the Fort George Island and the spheres doesn't end there, because in 2015, two of those famous Navy UFO videos are filmed. The gimbal video, and that one's the kind of famous one where it's that saucer and it rotates. It's kind of like the crowning picture. Anytime you look up the Navy UFO videos, it's the first one you see. Both of the second one's called the Go Fast, and it's this metal sphere, and it's going real fast over the ocean. And the camera operator's struggling to capture it, and then they lock on, and they're like, woo, we got it. In this kind of like genuine, like, what the fuck is that kind of moment? And it's hauling ass. Both of those videos were recorded while the Navy was doing practice runs outside of Mayport Station in Jacksonville, Florida. The waters where that metal sphere is flying, hauling ass, and the direction it's hauling ass towards is towards Fort George Island, where in 1974, this family found a metal sphere that moves on its own. And the fact that no one's brought up this connection in relation to those videos, so the most discussed UFO evidence in history at this point. And no one's been like, hey, you know, a few miles from where you filmed that metal sphere 40 years ago, they found this other metal sphere, which the Navy investigated again, which there's a trend here. There's the Navy is connected in these two instances of this island. And so it shows that, you know, a lot of people are looking at those UFO videos and saying, well, is it Russia? Is it China? Is it aliens from another planet? When the question is, the answer is a lot more complicated than something that simple. What does it mean that there's hundreds of years of haunting legends on this island? And then in 1974, they find this weird UFO legend sparks off. And then 40 years later, another exact copy of that UFO is seen in a few miles away over the ocean. I don't know exactly what it means, but it needs to be pointed out. And so my project is an attempt to bring up these connections. And it's an attempt to put some attention back on that haunted house, because unfortunately it is getting no attention. It's a dilapidated state. Throughout writing this project, I got in contact, or attempted to get in contact, multiple times with the Park Service. It's in a cultural, a national cultural park. So the national parks own a portion of the land, but there's also a state park that owns a portion of the land. And from my interactions, it seems that no one really knows who's in charge, because I've just been shuffled around to, oh, go ask them, oh, go ask them, oh, go ask them. Finally, I was told to ask, email an office in Tallahassee, who just never got back to me. So this house, this grand house, it was, again, built by a famous architect. Half of his buildings are already historical landmarks. And he called this one his most unique home. It's sitting there and it is falling apart. One of the wings was already torn down. It was the wing that Jerry Betts added herself. But the core of the original house is still standing, but not for long. So as an addition to this project, I've got a petition out there to save the Betts house, Betts/Neff house. So it can be not only investigated by paranormal weirdos like myself well into the future, but also because it's a piece of standing history, not only architectural history, but it's on an island where a few minutes, to the south, you have the Ribault Club, which has this little museum of the history of Jean Ribault, this French explorer who landed on the island and said the first Protestant prayer in North America. To the north, you have Kingsley Plantation, which is the source of a bunch of other haunting legends I get into in my book. But it's a plantation that's one of the strangest plantations in the U.S. because it has this weird, long after Spain sold Florida to the U.S., the guy who ran this plantation ran it in the Spanish way. And he thought mixed race people were superior to both white people and black people. Super bizarre guy. He had several African wives, and he gave one of them her own plantation. Super bizarre piece of history. And sitting in between these two historical sites is another one in the woods that is sitting there and being dilapidated. It's fallen apart. And at several times with several different crews, some professional film crews involved with TV shows and stuff, we tried to get permission to go and investigate at the house, and we never got it. So I just went there myself. I said, fuck it. no one from a legal perspective wanted to come with me. So I was like, all right, I'll just go there myself. And I went several times and investigated the house. And then I spent a night in the house testing out some interesting ghost technology. There's this whole ghost code device. There's the story of its inventor, and it's an interesting theory out there behind these spheres and what causes them. Of course, he's zoomed in on these spheres. It's the basis of this theory. And so I had to test it out at the Betts house, you know, the famous sphere house. I'll just say there were some interesting results. Get the book to find out what happened. But it was certainly an experience, and it's certainly one that should be preserved. It should be saved for future generations. You know, even if they don't want to let people paranormally investigate there, you know, at night or anything like that. You don't have to turn it into a sideshow or anything like that. It's a piece of standing history. Anyone who sees the house, it's one of those locations. What started this whole tirade, you asked me, what is a location you go to and you just you feel it? It was one of those ones. And my very supportive girlfriend came with me pretty much every time I went to the house. And she's a skeptic. She doesn't believe in, you know, things that go bump in the night, anything like that. But she wouldn't go in there. She stepped into the tower room, the front room, once, and she's like, that's enough. I'm out. I'm not going any deeper into this house. And it is. It's a structure that it's bizarre. It's got rooms that don't make sense. It's got like cabinets and things that you're like, what the fuck? That's bizarre. There's this set of grand double doors, but they're 6 feet off the floor. They're like sitting in the middle of the wall. It's a super you know, almost like one of those liminal spaces, but it's too ornate. It's like a castle on the inside. So it's too ornate to be liminal, but it's got that vibe where it feels otherworldly. And it's, you know, it's something that deserves our attention.
I'd really like to talk to the architect of that place and find out what his deal was. I mean, it reminds me of the Winchester House almost, but almost like on another level.
Yeah, well, the story of its design was Nettleton Neff, you know, the guy who died tragically. He actually drew up like his own designs or whatever and sent them to Melvin Greeley. He was a member at the Rebalt Club, which again was that snoozy fancy club. It's still there now. It's not quite as, it's more of like a museum now. But back then it was like, you know, where Great Gatsby would hang out. He lived in Jacksonville. And so Melvin Greeley had built the place and, you know, he was one of these famous architects. And so that's how he met Nettleton Neff. They were both members at this club. And he said, oh, you know, I want to build a house on the island and I want you to do it. Here are the drawings. And Melvin Greeley said, those are pretty good. I see what you're going for. Here's what that would look like. But, you know, your drawings inspired me. And I think this is the house you want. And Nettleton Neff said, hell yeah, that's it. That was what I was trying to do. And so it was kind of this weird brainchild of, you know, a dream of this depressed railroad magnate, Nettleton Neff, and Melvin Greeley, this famous architect. Again, this weird kind of amalgamation. And it's unlike anything, especially in Florida. And there's all kinds of rumors of like secret passageways, things like that, that are undiscovered inside the house. And it's just big enough to where you can be like, yeah, maybe. And there's parts that now, because of its dilapidated state, are inaccessible. There's a basement, whole basement area that you just can't really get to. Maybe if you had some equipment, you know, you could get down in there. But I wasn't trying it by myself. A lot of exposed asbestos. There's that attic room, the 6 foot off the wall doors. There was kind of a way you could gingerly climb up, but the floor is really worn thin right below it. So getting down, it's kind of like a booby trap. All kinds of stuff where, again, it's just this insane piece of history, even without the haunting legends and stuff, where it definitely deserves to be preserved. You know, the only people who go out there now are spray paint some half-baked nonsense on the front. I think there was a Let's Go Brandon, which, you know, take your politics off my history. I don't care what they are, but like, it's just a place that deserves to be a museum, you know, or fuck, sell it to me. I'll go like squat in it. What are the squatters' rights? How long do I got to live there before you give it to me? Someone's got to do something. So if you feel motivated to do it, follow the link in the description of this episode to the petition. Give it a sign and reach out to the, oh God, I'm blanking on his name, Rutherford. John Rutherford, I believe, is the congressman there in Duval County. Let him know that you think the Betts House should be saved, or call the parks and let them know that the Betts House should be saved. Or very easiest, go and just sign the petition and I'll go pester them for you. So yeah, thanks for letting me talk about that whole project. And the book is A Place Between Time and Space. It's a true story of UFOs, ghosts, and Florida's strangest home. So check that out. It is available on Amazon and as well through ParanormalityMag.com. They've been awesome in helping me get this published, getting the publicity out for this project. So go check out them and all the stuff they do.
Nice. So now you said you went to that house. Did you sleep there or were you just there for some hours in the night and then you went home?
So we actually camped at a campsite further down the road, Huguenot Memorial. And then we hiked after the sun went down, we hiked a few hours into the island and then to the house. And I spent almost around 6 hours. I spent essentially from 11 to 3 a.m. inside the house. 12 to 3 a.m. was when this ghost code device supposedly the best. And so, yeah, I spent the no sleeping involved. there's not a comfortable spot. A lot of broken glass. A lot of, again, torn up floors. It's in a rough state.
Right. Because then, yeah, once you said how it was kind of getting dilapidated, I was like, oh, I don't think you would have slept there, because I didn't
realize
how bad it was.
Probably 110 degrees in there after, you know, hiking that long and being in this, you know, no air conditioning. So it got hot, a lot of bugs. It was quite the investigation. But yeah, it's definitely, I don't think I could have slept if I wanted to. You know, it felt like I was in, what's the video game, Amnesia, where you wake up in a castle in Europe and there's all kinds of like Frankenstein monsters and shit around. It's a bizarre place. And it was an awesome experience to be in there and conduct a paranormal investigation. And I hope that we can get the state to save it, and we can conduct more and more as we go into the future.
And you said your results or your investigation stuff is in the book, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's something I would definitely want to check out.
Yeah. I don't want to give too many spoilers.
Nope. Let them go buy the book and read it. Yeah, you did all the work.
All kinds of weird stories in there, too. I really go into the history of the island and the other haunting legends that are, you know, that share the same space as the house. Because it's like one of these window areas you often read about, you know, where it's not one phenomenon, it's all kinds of. And this is definitely one of those locations. This is one of those islands where something's going on, something's weird. It's definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, I'm finding more and more that I'm getting into more of this stuff and kind of doing a little bit of my own research and visiting more places that are haunted and have this history. When you go back and you look at the history, there's so many things that are going on, and it's kind of like, is it because this one event happened here and then it draws other bad things in, or is it the land that it just is naturally gravitating towards it and just pulling the negative energy? It's really interesting. And to me, it seems like a lot of the stuff goes back to the Native Americans.
Yeah, there's definitely that legend associated with Fort George Island. It was occupied by Native Americans. When you drive through the center of the islands, you drive past these oyster shell middens, which are very common for the tribes in Florida. They leave behind, you know, these artificial hills made of oyster shell. And there's even some idea that the hill that the house is built onto is partially constructed by, you know, Native Americans. It was also the location of Fort George, with the islands named after, of this kind of British military installation, this old wooden fort. So again, you have the legends, you have the history. You know, the Native American one, who knows? That was one of those parts of the research where there just wasn't, because after the French were wiped out for their short time living near the island, the Spanish set up a mission there, and they didn't record, you know, anything about the Native traditions or this hill, Mount Cornelia. They call it a mountain because here in Florida we don't have mountains, but it's a hill. It's the tallest point in the county, tallest point around. So there's a safe assumption that it was of some kind of importance to the Native tribe that lived, you know, even if it's just like a lookout stand. Mm-hmm. Because it stands up higher than the rest of the area. I think, again, having that story there, whatever the story is, and again, having more stories, different possibilities, is the crucial part of it. You know, words are how we map our reality. And so stories can map the reality of these locations, these places. And if you have these window areas, a place like Fort George Island, where you have a couple different ghosts associated at the plantation, you have all these histories of, you know, the first Protestant prayer, Native settlements, the British fort, all kinds of history there. It kind of turns in reality into one of those choose your own adventure goosebumps, right? You're no longer living in the book that is and then I go to work, and then I do this, and then this. Now you're, okay, well, here I am, and this could happen, and this could happen, and this, and all of these potentials are there. And for whatever reason, sometimes the unlikely ending pops up, or the unlikely page, the twist shows up, and that's those paranormal situations where we follow the route that leads us to down the story that leads us to experiencing something bizarre.
So good. You are so full of so much information, and all these names and the history and everything. You just blow my mind every time I talk to you. I'm like, how does he remember all of this stuff?
I'm really nerdy about this one specific subject. It's awful talking to me about pretty much anything else. So.
Thank you so much for joining me on this. You're definitely going to come back again. You're going to have to find another subject and get nerdy on that so you can talk about that too.
Oh, hell yeah. I got plenty of more coming down the wire.
Awesome. Okay, so I guess once again, I know you kind of did it in the beginning, but just give everybody where they can find you, your book, everything. And of course, I'm going to put all your links in the show notes then too.
Yeah, you can find me on all the social medias at Chaz of the Dead. That's where I post little videos and stuff about haunted locations and whatnot.
Yeah.
You can
little videos too.
Find my writing and podcast appearances and all that stuff at chazofthedead.com. I write for Paranormality Magazine most months. You can find me in there. They're also an awesome organization that are publishing that book I was talking about, A Place Between Time and Space. So go to paranormalitymag.com to find not only some great magazines, but my books as well. Or you can get them on Amazon. And then, click the link in the description to sign the petition to save the Betts house. If that's the only thing you do today, that's awesome. Give yourself a gold star. Save a historical location. And it's never been easier. So go and sign that, if you will, please. And yeah, let's hopefully we can make a second one just about the house. We can move in and wire it up like paranormal activity. But it starts with saving it. So let's get it saved and fixed up first.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Of course. Anytime. Look forward to coming back.
All right. See you guys later.